You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/media-berkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
The phones have been ringing off the hook here at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, with calls from journalists and concerned citizens trying to make some sense of the story in progress that is WikiLeaks. So today we pulled together some of the brightest minds at the Berkman Center to talk about WikiLeaks, moderated by Jonathan Zittrain and Lauren Slesik. They explored many facets of the issue, including the values of transparency and freedom of speech, the legality and ethics of the WikiLeaks data dump, the role of the news media, and the involvement of government and private tech organizations to take WikiLeaks down. Thanks so much to all the journalists, commenters, and tweeters who sent in their questions for today's show. We've got a few additional resources to help folks make sense of WikiLeaks over on our show notes at blogs.law.harvard.edu/media-berkman, including a link to Jonathan Zittrain's growing Frequently Asked Questions post on WikiLeaks. And this show is distributed under a Creative Commons license, so you can feel free to take any part of it and reuse it for your own purposes. So without further ado, here are Jonathan Zittrain and Lauren Slesik.
Today is Tuesday, the 7th of December, a day that will live in infamy, it seems. And my name is Jonathan Zittrain. I teach at Harvard University. I'm here with my colleague and friend, Larry Lessig.
Hi, Jonathan.
With whom we have been doing together a series of podcasts on various internet issues. And today we have a rather unusual format. We have crashed the Fellows Hour of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, so we're in a room full of approximately 25 people. That's not a National Park Service estimate, so it's probably accurate, who have, in an experience like this, tried to get together and talk about issues in a way that we're still thinking stuff through. We're sharing both kind of ideas about ought and is with each other, what ought to be happening, what is happening. And we thought what we would do this week is record our conversations as they've been going on and share them with you, the internet at large. What could possibly go wrong? So today's topic this week is WikiLeaks. This is a subject for which already among us there's been a lot of admission that pretty much everybody to a T in this room feels greatly conflicted. And that's a kind of rare circumstance. Often it's everybody feels very strongly one way, or people feel strongly in lots of different ways, but rare is it that you find such sort of ambivalence within this group, and we wanted to try to out that. First, just to get started, a few facts, and I welcome correction or refinement either live from the people in this room or later as we go through. We'll have an accompanying Frequently Asked Questions document that we'll keep updated about this situation. But at least at the bare level, the facts are WikiLeaks was founded in 2006. Exactly by whom is not clear. Who is a member and who runs it is not entirely clear. There's a guy named Julian Assange, variously described as a member of its advisory board, its founder, its benefactor, etc., who is sort of, at least in the public eye, become the face of WikiLeaks. And it originally was a wiki in the sense of running a piece of software that allowed people from pretty much anywhere to make edits to the pages that one might see on the website containing the software. Its initial statement of purpose was, quote, its primary interest is in exposing oppressive regimes in Asia, the former Soviet bloc, sub-Saharan Africa, and the Middle East. We also expect to be of assistance to people of all regions who wish to reveal unethical behavior in their governments and corporations. But even then, in 2006 at the time, Assange had been writing an essay with a sort of different cast on it. Here's one just brief outtake from it. An authoritarian conspiracy that cannot think efficiently, cannot act to preserve itself against the opponents it induces. When we look at a conspiracy as an organic whole, we can see a system of interacting organs, a body with arteries and veins, whose blood may be thickened and slowed till it falls, unable to sufficiently comprehend and control the forces in its environment. And that said, at least in Assange's own words, one view may be, leaking is not to expose a particular wrong at a particular time, though that may also be part of it, but rather the harder you can make it, he seems to say, for a government or a corporation to keep secrets, the more paranoid the people within that organization become, the less they share with one another, and the slower their blood runs as an organic creature. So what's happened most recently to bring things into the news so starkly? Most recently, 251,287 classified documents from the United States have been apparently brought into WikiLeaks' custody. They, in turn, have shared those documents with four newspapers, Le Monde, El País, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel. The Guardian then, in a fit of sharing, sent them to the New York Times. Of those documents, only a small comparative handful have actually been made available to the public, namely 960 of them, and those in redacted form. The redactions seem to vary slightly. This exposure of documents, 250,000 possibly available but not yet available, 960 of them available, and more we gather to be released over time, either by the four media, now five media partners who have them, or by WikiLeaks itself, possibly as part of a mysterious insurance file, which may even be larger than just that release. This is a file that's been made widely available but is inscrutable. It is highly encrypted. So should a password be released, suddenly everybody holding this inscrutable file could find out what's inside. But in the meantime, those who know what's inside, we don't even know who they are, and we don't know what's in it. Anyway, this release follows on the release of separate tranches of incidents and other government documents from the American Defense Department concerning the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. The Iraq release was about 391,000 incident reports and about 90,000 records relating to Afghanistan, for which, again, 15,000 are said to have been withheld. What will happen next? We don't know. There appear to be more releases in the offing. That may mean that more of the 250,000 cables that have not yet been released will be released by the newspapers according to their own conscience and schedule, or by WikiLeaks, and there might even be more additional leaks that's been suggested, at least, that they might be coming. That's kind of my quick capitulation of the facts as we know them in early December of 2010. Is there anything anybody wants to add or ask just on the factual level before we try to start thinking through this stuff? Hello, Ethan Zuckerman.
Wait, just a quick question. I was wondering if you wanted to talk briefly about some of the closures of accounts of WikiLeaks that seemed like an important part of the fact pattern before we jump into this.
The yeah, that's certainly part of the current state of play. Ethan, do you want to talk about that, or do you want me to do my best?
Why don't you do your best? You have this wonderful radio voice, and you seem to have the facts all at hand, Jonathan.
I'm nothing if not stentorian. So, what we know is that WikiLeaks.org is a website hosted at a particular location. In fact, I believe there has been evidence of it being a bunkerized location, kind of looking like Superman's Fortress of Solitude in a northern clime. That has been, from time to time, unavailable. In fact, it may be unavailable right now, and that's because complications having to do with the domain name system. You type in WikiLeaks.org, it has to resolve to an AMERIC address. For it to resolve to an AMERIC address, there's a record held by the .org people that points to the computer that knows where that address is. And that computer is supposed to be one that the holder of the domain name, in this case WikiLeaks.org, designates. That computer was a computer run by a service called EasyDNS, whose purpose is to get asked about where things like WikiLeaks.org are and to give answers. That computer was subject, we think, to a denial of service attack. EasyDNS, as a result, I'm being told no by Jill.
It's every DNS. EasyDNS has unfortunately been caught up in the media storm.
Let us be clear. EasyDNS and every DNS are completely different. They're just confusingly similar. So for those of you at EasyDNS, we're sorry. And you offer these services for a fee, so please patronize EasyDNS, except for the fact that people keep confusing it with every DNS and targeting it with denial of service attacks, so maybe they're not the best choice. But anyway, every DNS is the entity that was hosting the computer that said where WikiLeaks.org is. That computer came under repeated denial of service attacks, sources unknown, and as a result, every DNS decided to stop answering that question. And so far as we know, the WikiLeaks, whoever runs that, has not gotten in touch with the .org people to give them a different computer to whom to send the query about where to find WikiLeaks.org. In the meantime, WikiLeaks.ch and other versions of WikiLeaks websites remain up and available, perhaps subject to denial of service. I don't know. I haven't visited them. And there is some sense in which these documents, some of them are available on the websites of the respective newspapers to whom the documents have been released in differing forms raw. And there's also some sense in which they may have crept onto the peer-to-peer torrent and file-sharing networks. Normally the province of copyrighted music, now there may be these things floating around the networks. Ethan?
That's been an explicit part of WikiLeaks' strategy. And the sort of definitive archive of the cables is released as a torrent. That torrent file is updated on a regular basis. To a large extent, the website is primarily background information on what's going on. You can access the cables, or in many cases, you've been able to access the cables through the website. But a complete archive has been available throughout via BitTorrent on a continually updated torrent file, which to a certain extent has obviated WikiLeaks.org or the other sites being either down because a service provider has stopped providing service or because of distributed denial of service attack.
But to be clear about when you say complete archive, what you mean is a complete archive of the selected chunk of material they've decided to release from the total set that they have in their
Correct. That's the 960, not the 251,287. Those may or may not be in the encrypted insurance file.
But there's more to what Ethan was talking about, right?
Yes. There's the PayPal angle and the Amazon angle, so we might as well talk about
the MasterCard and the Visa.
Correct. So other places where pressure has been applied to try to separate people from these cables and people from WikiLeaks or WikiLeaks from itself, slowing the body with arteries and veins, as they might say, is that it was hosted using Amazon Enterprise servers for a while. Amazon doesn't just sell you books and trinkets. It offers cloud-based cash-and-carry wholesale hosting services to anybody that wants to pay. That anybody for a while included WikiLeaks. And then, as the story goes in the news, we had Senator Lieberman get in touch with Amazon and say, are you with us or against us? Amazon, which has a terms of service that gives it great discretion in choosing what sites it wishes to host, if it were but to think about it, thought about it, and decided it didn't want to be in the business of hosting WikiLeaks, at which point WikiLeaks went down off that hosting and is now hosted elsewhere. I think back in Europe appears to be the latest rumor. The other links that have been come under pressure have been severed are, for a while, WikiLeaks was raising money via PayPal and via MasterCard and Visa. All three of those intermediaries have, on their own initiative or, you know, with the encouragement of various government bodies, decided not to process and, in fact, may have seized, it's not clear, monies from people being directed at the WikiLeaks organization. Are there any other intermediaries worth talking about right now, Jill? Jill York?
The other one is Tableau Software, which was hosting data visualizations of WikiLeaks. I'm not sure if it was people from WikiLeaks or outsiders who put them up, but they publicly stated that their response was, in fact, to Senator Lieberman's call.
Got it. And one other example I heard from...
When the PayPal... This is Jeffrey Schnapp. When the PayPal conduit was closed down, they were relying on I think there were credit donations passing through a Swiss bank account, which was also closed down. It was a public post office account.
Got it. And I guess there might even be bank accounts that are being frozen or not as time goes on. So a lot of the pressure points we see coming up that come into play with, you know, unlicensed pharmaceuticals selling Viagra that a given country shouldn't be, child abuse images, the usual tools that get deployed against them are in progress in various ways through pressure or suasion more than through formal legal process. It looks being deployed against WikiLeaks, the organization, and to some extent the websites, bracketed by Ethan's observation that it's a lot harder to pull this off with a torrented network. Those who are downloading the torrent should be aware that the nature of peer-to-peer tends to mean if you are downloading, you are also sharing. That's how a torrent works. So the act of reading the cables is also the act of making them available to others. Okay, that's pretty much our articulation of the facts. Now let's turn to the rest of it. And this is the way I think the media tends to move next. So for better or worse, let's start with this question and try to get to it in as subtle a way as we can. People are trying to figure out for whom to cheer here. And the list of characters is a conflicted one. It could include the governments or specific government. It could include Julian Assange. It could include WikiLeaks. It could include the press. So I'm curious, is there anybody who wants to offer up somebody for whom they are particularly cheering for or against in this tableau as a way of figuring out who's right and wrong in all this? Larry, should I cold call you to get started?
You could. Do you want to?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, I'd like to kind of reframe it in the way that makes WikiLeaks' case strongest. Because I think the general understanding of what exactly has happened and who did what obscures this. So let's say WikiLeaks had announced its policy as the following. We've got a whole bunch of documents that are secret and classified that were given to us by some person who probably shouldn't have, but he did.
And that person, by the way, appears in part, but it's also unclear, to be Bradley Manning, a U.S. soldier who had access to a lot of this stuff. But it has been unclear whether he's been the sole source of that which is being released. Manning has been caught and is in jail and, from what we can tell, does not have an internet connection.
Manning, if you're there, could you call in? Okay, so let's say that we get this information, and what we do is we turn it over to a bunch of respectable newspapers from around the world. And we could have arguments about what respectable is, but the four that they picked might not be liked by Fox News, but they're not crazies. And those respectable newspapers start writing about the stuff we've given them. And then what we do as WikiLeaks is we make accessible to the public the stuff that they're talking about when they write about us. Now, if that's all that's happened here, one thing that I find extraordinary is the unthinking kind of Lieberman-esque reaction to this that says that what we ought to be doing is bringing the full moral suasion of the government and more against any entity that's trying to enable this thing to happen, right? Because, in fact, in that description of the case, the newspapers are in some sense taking the lead in discussing and deciding what issues are of public import to be considered and discussed. And all that they're doing is providing a public backup source to that sort of information. So if it's framed like that, what's the argument against WikiLeaks?
Well, I suppose one argument is because this isn't being released in the context of, say, the Pentagon Papers, which might really, in retrospect especially, be one of the most sympathetic examples of a leak, where in retrospect the Republic still stood, there was no great harm to national security, it helped with internal truth-telling for the United States to have the Pentagon Papers available, and from what we can tell, it did not reveal crucial sources and methods or put people in danger maybe mentioned in the paper. So that's kind of like the gold standard.
But that's why I framed it like this, because it seems to plug right into the Pentagon paper standard, because I thought the point of the Pentagon Papers was that we have a tradition of protecting the journalists' decisions to publish or not to publish certain information. Now, that doesn't mean people who illegally release the information won't be prosecuted. They will be. But if the facts are as I've described them, and all WikiLeaks is doing is providing the backup to effectively, you know, with the equivalent of the New York Times or
it's
the Washington Post.
It's like a caching server of all this stuff.
For the newspapers. Yes. So it's like the modern internet version of what the Pentagon Papers. You wouldn't have gone out and bought those books. I still remember going out and buying those books, you know, when it first came out. You'd just be getting it off the internet. What could the complaint be against? What's the complaint against it? And more pointedly, isn't it outrageous that we're motivating this political action against effectively newspapers deciding what information they ought to be publishing about matters they consider to be in public import on the basis of information they've gotten, not themselves, through any criminal activity?
Well, and one prosaic concern that we've heard expressed by the U.S. government and by others has been, to the extent that you actually see stuff worth redacting because it really could put people in danger, You're not just holding this in Ben Bradley's desk at the Washington Post with a lock on it and, we presume, decent security at the Washington Post building. You're strewing it all over the place. It's on servers. The kind of sophisticated parties who are the worst entities into whose hands these documents could fall just know that if they hack WikiLeaks, they've got the whole trove. And that might be the worst of both worlds then, because...
Right, by hacking WikiLeaks, now what you're describing is getting more of the cables than the things that the newspaper
Correct.
Released?
That there's okay. stuff the public doesn't see being held in this pen for sifting. And it's not even like it's a classic fishing expedition. It's not as if specific things were leaked because there was an overriding corruption or issue to be broached, and then we further redact them to try to even better balance the pluses and minuses of making this stuff public. But rather, we take just a huge scoop into the stream of stuff that is classified information, pour it into this unsecure location, and then hope that they kind of more or less redact it well. That feels a lot different than the Pentagon Papers, doesn't it?
That does. But again, I want to isolate that for a second and make sure that I understand the outrage or the anger against what in fact happens here. If in fact what happens here is nothing more than providing the backup for the material which journalists believe it's important and relevant to be discussing out in the public. Because, you know, just some backstory to our conversation here, in the beginning part of our conversation, not recorded and not even available on WikiLeaks yet, Ethan Zuckerman gave us a nice framing of what you might think of as the stages of WikiLeaks life. And I'm going to ask you to reframe it for this conversation. But the thing we were struggling with in that conversation is, how do we understand what I'll call stage three and the appropriate response to stage three disclosure? And I guess what I'm wondering is, have I described the appropriate thing in stage three disclosures? Meaning, in stage three disclosure, which you'll understand in a second, newspapers get to go through it, exercising journalistic judgment, decide which things are appropriate to be published, publish them, and then WikiLeaks is completely fine, has a safe harbor if all they're doing is reflecting what the newspapers say ought to be published.
This is Ethan Zuckerman. Just to refer back to this taxonomy that I proposed, I was suggesting that early on in WikiLeaks, we could think of WikiLeaks as essentially providing protection services or brokering services for individual whistleblowers. So we saw documents released having to do with an assassination plot in Somalia, having to do with corruption in the Moi regime in Kenya, having to do with commercial dealings in the Turks and Caicos. And essentially what WikiLeaks was doing was taking information from individuals who were leaking it, releasing it to the general public. In a second phase, we saw WikiLeaks take on what you might think of as...
So they weren't filtering it at all, is what you're saying. They were basically taking it and pushing it out.
Well, it's unclear.
Okay.
It's unclear in stage one whether if I had come up with your personal health records, Jonathan, and submitted it to WikiLeaks, whether they would have refused it at that point.
Okay.
But what they were trying to do was make it possible for an individual leaker to protect her or his identity.
They saw themselves as basically doing pass-through.
That's my belief.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
And I think early on in that, there was also the assumption that for information that was difficult to source, like the Somali information, there might be an online function where people could come and discuss the authenticity of the documents.
Got it.
In what I'm characterizing as a second phase, we saw what I'm thinking of as an advocacy journalism phase. And I would put the collateral murder video in that camp. A specific leak of a video from the U.S. government, but edited and contextualized and released with a title that had a very strong point of view, as well as edited with a narrative associated with it to make a particular set of political points, that seemed like WikiLeaks was no longer simply acting as the broker for a whistleblower, but was putting forth a specific agenda. In phase three, as Larry just referred to, we're now talking about leaking of a large collection of data. And this is a phase that is probably made possible by Bradley Manning, or that's who's currently being accused of it, or someone else with access to a large number of U.S. government documents. And in phase three, there seems to be a recognition that WikiLeaks as an organization can't sort through the data and therefore either needs to partner with a journalistic organization to sort through and make sense of it. But there's this other challenge, which is that in releasing the data to the web, there is a need to scrub the data somehow to deal with some of these concerns raised by human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch about potential collateral damage. I would also just raise in the conversation we had leading up to this, there was sort of the phase that hasn't happened, and it's worth noting that it hasn't happened, which would be WikiLeaks essentially releasing all of these documents without scrubbing them or releasing them all at once.
Which may represent the insurance file.
Which might represent the insurance file or might represent a nihilistic completion of the project. But it's worth noting that it hasn't happened, suggesting that there's a deeper logic going on.
And I guess as a matter of fact, again, on the third phase, we understand that WikiLeaks reached out to the U.S. State Department and said, would you like to work with us on redacting this stuff? You can imagine it kind of puts the State Department into a dilemma. It legitimates them to say, yes, let's sit down and do this. And if they don't do it, it runs the risk that they won't be properly redacted. To our knowledge, the State Department did not agree to sit down with WikiLeaks and do this. There may be connections or communications between the State Department and the New York Times, or possibly the State Department and the non-U.S. publications to work on the redactions. I don't think we know that. Okay, so back to you, Larry. Your point about phase three was what? If that's what they're doing, that's something that we should not be so much against.
Well, I guess I'd restate it like this. We're into the stage of journalism where stage three dumps are going to happen all the time. Whether WikiLeaks survives or not, there are going to be people who come collecting a whole ton of data, let's say Bank of America data that is also threatened now, or possibly Bank of America to be released or whatever. People who believe that there's a reason to be releasing a ton of data come to some entity and want to release the data. And the question is, what's the appropriate way to handle this? One way to handle it, one way that I would think is completely irresponsible, would be just to say, okay, just publish it all. We're just going to put it all out there. I don't care what the consequences is, put it all out there. I think that's extraordinarily juvenile. But again, as Ethan has said, notice that's not what WikiLeaks did. WikiLeaks has done something much less than that. The other extreme of that might be for them, you know, the entity, let's call it WikiLeaks version 2, to basically say, okay, we've got this data. Now we're going to basically turn over the judgment to a trusted third party, New York Times or The Guardian. And in that context, it would be hard to see, you know, if The Guardian had taken it on themselves, if The New York Times had taken it on themselves.
It's hard to imagine The Guardian website coming under attack or
absolutely.
Calls
or Joe
the assassination
Lieberman.
Of the
right.
editor of The Guardian.
Exactly right. Yeah. So we're now talking about some space between these two extremes. And the question is, what are the appropriate set of rules that should govern in that space?
Judith Donath.
I guess one question also is that even if WikiLeaks ceases to be the entity that's doing this type of thing, it seems unlikely that there won't be sort of a permanent set of entities of this type, some perhaps more mischievous than WikiLeaks, sort of the 4chan WikiLeaks version. And I think one of the questions is, what is the difference as the secrets move from being government secrets to corporate secrets to personal secrets? When you asked earlier, you know, is there someone you feel you're for or against? My immediate response is the person I would be against is Joe Lieberman, who I think has behaved quite irresponsibly. But I think it's a response born of fear of looking into this sort of abyss of a world like a war on secrecy. So what does that look like if you assume that this is a permanent condition of there being perhaps less responsible entities than WikiLeaks being open for inescapable publishing of anything.
And if we buy Ethan's three phases of WikiLeaks' own existence, that's showing some movement in the direction of trying to be more responsible and more news organization-like. It's almost, to use the analogy to the music and copyright industries, it's like if you kill Napster, you might well be creating Nutella and ultimately more distributed versions of things for which it's harder to tell the entire BitTorrent network to shape up. Come on, be more responsible, torrent network, where you could have done that possibly with Napster. It just seemed like you were treating with the devil to sit down in a room with Napster and try to negotiate. So the same dilemma might be here. You could imagine for those with secrets to protect, legitimately or not, dealing with WikiLeaks and actually helping their brand but also temporizing them might in retrospect be better than allowing the 4chans to take over. Susan Landau was wanting to get in.
So I had two things I wanted to say. The first is that the Times, that in my memory, the Times has twice not published stories that in retrospect it was sorry not to have published, at least at the time. One was when it became aware that the U.S. was planning to invade Cuba in 1962. It got asked by the White House not to publish. They think that if they had done so, maybe Bay of Pigs wouldn't have happened.
So their regret is not necessarily ethical, it's just a regret that the Bay of Pigs thing didn't.
They think they did not act responsibly.
Okay.
The second time was on the warrantless wiretapping that they reported on in 2005. They sat on the story for a year, again asked by the White House to do so. The second point, and so they're, you know, just to show that the newspapers have a full panoply of actions. The second point is that one of the reasons that one of the likely reasons for Manning to have access to all the cables, if in fact the diplomatic cables were leaked by Manning, is the effort by the government post-September 11th to do much more information sharing. But when you do that type of information sharing, you also have to think very, very carefully about what things you keep secret and what things you don't. And you want to limit the number of things that are secret, because otherwise you end up in a situation where low-level people have access to many, many secrets.
Yeah, but I think that if we think about this as an inevitable progression, and I like the idea of saying, you know, if this is now an event, big data dumps, WikiLeaks as the recipient, the next stage will be any number of entities as a recipient. It's almost as if we're brought to the world that David Brin was writing about in his book Transparent Society, but thinking now not so much about, I mean, the focus in that book was all of these issues, but privacy was the one that got people going. But now we're thinking about from the other side, the government secret
side. In his book, basically, it's hard to boil down a book, but his prescription was, as long as the watchers are going to be watching us, we won't have much privacy against our own governments, at least we hope we can watch the governments. So with somebody watching the watchers, maybe it all comes out in the wash.
Right. So the first important part of that boiled down version, though, is to insist that the technology is driving us to a place where there's no ability to imagine keeping secrets anymore, either side, right, the government or our individuals. So we need to evolve a set of responses for getting what we need out of privacy without imagining that we're going to be controlling access to information. And it had a kind of, in my view, Panglossian view about the way everybody would kind of work it all out, which seems even harder to believe now in the context of what we've seen in this very limited instance of it with this WikiLeaks.
And in fact, you've written in the New Republic recently against transparency, which at least by the titles appears to clash with Brin's theory.
Yeah. Right. It's even harder to summarize my articles in a short form.
You flatter yourself.
I was criticizing myself because so many people have argued, including at this table, that there's something confused about the argument. But my point, you know, I bought an evocative title to almost demonstrate the point of the article. So one part of the article was arguing that, you know, we have to acknowledge there's such a thing as an attention span problem in the world. An attention span problem is, imagine anytime you've got a bit of information that it takes 30 seconds to understand, but a rational, reasonable person would only spend 10 seconds listening to it, much like this commentary I'm making right now.
I was already thinking about something else, actually. Bring home milk.
In that kind of context, the information will be systematically misunderstood because people will not pay enough attention to understand it, and so you'll have an impression of it that's completely not the impression you're supposed to have. So that was a 6,000-word article in the New Republic. I wanted to demonstrate the attention span problem by calling it against transparency. People wrote these furious
arguments. Hoping that people would misunderstand it, thereby showing your point. You're a brilliant one, Professor Lessig.
Well, right. The first stage happened. People misunderstood it. There are few who then tried to, you know, put it in context, which was the thing I'm I was hoping for, which was to demonstrate that, you know, it's going to take more to understand these points. And the WikiLeaks example, I think, is bringing this out in spades, right? Because there's all sorts of things which, as it gets snipped by The Guardian or whomever, and we get to see the thing that's being referred to, it's out of context. It has no real meaning. It creates all sorts of anger and frustration, which is not producing understanding or knowledge out there. And that's a particular version of the problem that this is.
So is what you're saying that it is basically tragic to see these releases happening of the fishing expedition variety. Here's a bunch of stuff that will then be grazed over for kind of little stories or contextless bad things or misunderstood things. It is both tragic, but you also see it as inevitable?
Yeah. I think is inevitable. And so the question is, what's the appropriate response? And again,
which, by the way, also maps very much to your view on copyright, it sounds like, that you think it's actually a bad thing to see wholesale, bit-for-bit piracy or copying of copyrighted materials going on through the very networks that are now carrying this stuff. But you also think it's inevitable and people should deal with it.
Yeah, and deal with it in a way that addresses the objective of copyright by compensating artists.
Yes.
So, I think you have to accept the consequences of the new technological infrastructure and figure out what the best way to respond to it is. And so, again, going back to the question I framed, imagine WikiLeaks on day one and said, here's what we've got and here's how we're going to behave. We are only going to release the stuff that responsible journalists believe needs to be referenced, and we'll give you what we've got if they talk about it. But it's their judgment to talk about it. If they had done that, what would the debate have been? You know, would they have been responsible? I mean, would the world have viewed them as responsible for anything?
If they had basically been a mere data warehouse?
Yeah, we are the warehouse. We're the cash,
and we will accept help from governments who want to make our warehouse as secure as possible, so that the redacted stuff can't be leaky.
But it's El País who's making the decision about what information needs to be published.
Yes. Harry Lewis, former dean of Harvard College.
Taking Susan's point and yours then, if it's inevitable that this is going to happen more and more, after all, you know, maybe they'll be able to arrest and throw Mr. Assange in jail for long enough that not a single other person who has the technological capability would ever dare try doing such a thing again, but it doesn't seem likely. So if it's going to keep happening, isn't the effect of this, in fact, going to be to change the secrecy management protocols?
It certainly will. But I was taking the next step to Susan's point.
Would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
By the way, changing them, you think it'll make, as Assange predicted or wanted in his 2006 essay, you think it will make for much less information sharing internal to a government, so there are fewer points of leakage?
Well, I don't know.
No, actually, there's a lot. I think Susan's model had a lot of moving parts in it, right? You can see it as deciding we're not going to make secret a whole bunch of things because it's creating all sorts of problems. On the other side, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan had argued and others have made very strong, the whole problem with secrecy is it's a currency inside of a government. And so you have a natural tendency to more of it and a very strong resistance from releasing any of it. So that those are two things pushing in opposite directions. And you can't, I don't have a sense of which is going to win. But I certainly think this is going to lead them to rethink at how they actually make data available, making data less available. But I guess I'm embracing the Brin assumption that whatever they do, if the data is out there in some tangible form, it's been recorded someplace, there are going to be people who figure out how to grab it and release it. And the question we need to figure out is, what do we do? How do we live in such a world to get us what we need?
And there you could at least see a government wanting to signal. This is purely just a symbolic, but not just a symbolic, an important symbolic thing. A government might say, we don't want this to become so legitimated that it's just up there at a website, hosted at Amazon, no cash and carry access. Fine, if you want it, you're going to have to go to the torrent zone and get it and realize this is gray market stuff if it's not necessarily illegal, something we haven't talked about yet, how illegal each stage of this might or might not be. But you could see a government wanting to do that, even though they know the entities that most want it will still get to it, including other governments that will be very eager to see this stuff. Does that make sense to you as a government that they would want at least not to legitimate it so much that it's just one click away for anyone?
But again, so let's just be precise of the it. The it is the stuff that's been talked about by the press, or the it is the full archive?
The full archive.
Yeah, of course, they shouldn't want, and they want to, I think they have proper reason to try to block one-click access to the full archive. We haven't gotten, you know, even to the stage of defending the idea of releasing the full archive. But again, I'm thinking about you know, before that. What would the criticism have been? What's our argument against it?
I guess the criticism against it would be there are people who think it is the job of the press to keep the government honest, but that you judge how illegal, how worth chasing after the press or any intermediary is on the basis of looking at the substance of what they are releasing. If they redact a cable so that obvious sources are not compromised, but they're otherwise giving access to private government communications that would not be FOIA-able or otherwise accessible for years to come, and there's no particular great revelation that comes with it, you still might think that is not Pentagon Papers. That is not good stuff, and the government would be entitled to try to prevent that. And in fact, in the Pentagon Papers case, as I understand it, the reason the New York Times was able to win that case was because the balance of benefit and public insight provided by the Pentagon Papers versus the harm of releasing them in the form they were released was so clearly in favor of public disclosure.
Yeah, I would give a different reading. Uh-huh. My reading would be the judgment was the decision about publishing and what ought to be published was the decision we vest in the press. That's what the free speech clause and free press clause mean. And the government's ability to step in and block it was the thing presumptively suspect.
Presumptively suspect, but you could rebut that. If the New York Times, in its bizarre wisdom, chose to start releasing people's credit card numbers or who knows what, you could see the government going for a so-called prior restraint. I want it stopped now. And, of course, if you don't get the prior restraint, what they were really saying was, look, let the Times do its thing. We don't think that the evil of this release is so much that it requires the very strong medicine of a prior restraint, but then go sue them in court later for whatever you're going to sue them for.
Right. But in that framing, if you know, WikiLeaks gives all of these cables to The Guardian, then The Guardian goes through it and says, here are the things that we think are interesting and ought to be talked about. Even if you and I and the United States government, of which you apparently are a part, would say, this is ridiculous. This is outrageous. This should not be discussed. The point is, the whole meaning of the case is to say that's Guardian's judgment. And they might be subject to all sorts of liability ex post, but it's very hard to get over the burden.
Very hard, but not impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joseph Riegel wants to weigh in.
So I've just been wondering about people's opinions on the media's judgment, particularly with respect to the cable releases, and whether they reflected an element of wikiality. In that a lot of the things I've seen have been little more than sort of State Department gossip.
Tell us what wikiality is.
So wikiality is a concept coined in the context of Wikipedia by Stephen Colbert to say there's this funny phenomena that Wikipedia is understood to reflect the things that are important in the world. And interestingly enough, you can do something trivial, get it noticed at Wikipedia, which then people will say this is trivia, we're going to delete it. But the fact that it was at Wikipedia is then reported upon, which becomes a sort of self-sustaining phenomena. And Wikipedia is now able to sort of change the world it seeks to document. And so relying upon the press to be this arbiter, my sense with respect to the latest leaks is, why am I reading this? Who cares? So I'm just wondering whether that's even a good decision, really.
These stuff don't meet the notability standard.
In a way, yeah, and Wikipedia speaks.
I think it's a great point, but that's why I think this framing helps us see that point, because we're attacking WikiLeaks. Maybe we should be attacking the press, right? The people who've actually decided to report on the stuff that WikiLeaks is now releasing, right, releasing to the rest of us.
But WikiLeaks itself is the story, and so they have to substantiate it with this trivia and gossip.
Right.
Brad Abruzzi, just Berkman Fellow. I wonder if, you know, a concern about the data, you know, we could accept that the data is just going to be available. Is it maybe the data doesn't get generated to begin with and there's value to having it? I mean, what I've drawn from the Times publication is that, you know, they are releasing things that are gossipy to us. And yet I think the substance of those cables is probably useful from a diplomatic perspective. That is, it's interesting for us to know what, how we assess the character of President Sarkozy, for example. But that information may actually be useful in our dealings with him. To the extent that, you know, there's anything useful to be gleaned from...
When you say us, who do you mean?
When did I say us?
They might be useful to us in dealing with...
they might be useful to the government, I'm sorry. So, you know, one of the things that we always sort of bandy about in the law is that, you know, confidentiality... assurances of confidentiality are important because they induce candor. Are we all going to be less candid generally with one another on the idea that everything that we communicate via the internet could subsequently be delivered to people that we don't want to see it?
Or we just might see the goods going to media that are more ephemeral. That I put something in a cable, but disregard that. Give me a call, and I'll tell you what's really going on, which would be detrimental. Both in the short term, because it's harder to share among the people who ought to know it, and in the long term, because it means the historical record will no longer be any different from a public press release.
Yeah, the emails in the White House is a perfect example of this. I mean, it's, you know, that's an extraordinary technology that you would hope that the top of our government was able to use, but they can't because it produces records which they're not able to do anything useful with.
Where's Gasser, the executive director of the Berkman Center?
Thanks. I have a question for you. I'm intrigued by this analogy to copyright and the copyright war. And looking at the copyright story, of course, there was not only the fight against the legitimate sources, the peer-to-peer networks, but there was also the emergence of legitimate sources of online music distribution, iTunes as an example. Now, taking this analogy not too far, of course, but what can that possibly teach us when we look for appropriate responses in a kind of WikiLeaks 2.0 environment? Would it be possible, in your view, that actually society would respond by, and governments would start thinking about legitimate ways of whistleblowing of government secrets, for instance? Obviously, we're concerned and supportive of the release of certain information that has value. We mentioned a few examples where we are less in favor of the release of packages of information where we do not even know what the point is of releasing those documents. Now, in the corporate sector, obviously, we have seen whistleblower legislation where we try to channel some of the energy create some incentives, what kind of information actually should be released, where you then also offer in return certain protection to the whistleblower. Is a regime like that a totally fantasy out of space, or is that something you would see as a possibility for a more mature response of a learning system?
Well, I certainly obviously agree with the idea, let's figure out how to accept the technology and live with it. And I think that the copyright analogy is useful, but I think there's a very important distinction here to keep clear. One of the reasons why I think the world can survive pretty well with leaky control of the distribution of copyrighted material is that, you know, once a particular song gets out there, it doesn't destroy the market that might exist for that song. I mean, you know, there's a huge market for iTunes music, even though there's also a huge market of, quote, free music that's available illegally using BitTorrent.
Which is to say, a little bit of shoplifting is not fatal to Walmart.
It's different. I'm more strongly against
tangible theft.
Yeah,
metaphors.
Absolutely. But the point is,
even though they're so clarifying,
yeah, or confusing. That's the problem. But the point is, you can have a little bit of leak here without destroying the objective. But in the context of a secret, you know, the
leaking
leak
is bad.
You know, so if you do something like march tanks in Tiananmen Square on your own citizens, and if somebody snaps a picture of this and releases it, it's not like, you know, you can tolerate the fact that the secret has now gotten out if your whole objective is to block the secret from getting out. And that's why I'm a little bit less confident that we're going to have something like the negotiated deal with state departments where, okay, we've got this stuff, and they sit down and say, okay, you've got us. Now let's just talk about how you're going to release the stuff that you've gotten in a way that doesn't do too much harm to us. I just think it's...
That seems right. Just one commensurate advantage that the governments might have that isn't quite reflected in the Tiananmen hypothetical is...
Which government do you work for?
We're all friends here. Is the idea that many of the secrets originate in government. And in fact, what makes them so sensitive is just the fact that someone in government thinks that. It's like, you know, I believe X about this country. It's sensitive that a U.S. government official believes that rather than I just got this amazing insight about this country. And those secrets may be easier to keep because in the music industry, the name of the game is to get the music out to the public that's paid for it while somehow keeping away the public that didn't. And here, you're not trying to get it out to the public. You are trying to keep it secure. And it's probably worth noting that the stuff in question, so far as we can tell, has been rated. There's a spectrum of secrecy, and it hasn't been at the highest levels of secrecy. And as you go further along that spectrum, the systems allowed to contain the secrets, the people who are entitled to be exposed to them, those actually change dramatically. So it may just mean top secret means top secret, and that we may still be able to think we can keep that secret pretty well. We shouldn't give up on it and ratify those who would leak. But then there's this intermediate range called secret that maybe isn't such a big deal if it should leak. And, of course, a lot of reaction to the cables has been, gee, I guess the government is pretty good at what it does. It's actually pretty canny about evaluating things, even though it's a little sensitive to see that it wasn't all smiles and handshakes at a given meeting about which a report was written. I wanted to ask you quickly, Larry, in the midst of this, as the government has been trying to deal with the U.S. government with a rather new situation, there's word that filtered out, for example, at Columbia, a graduate school there, said that they had heard from someone at the State Department who just wanted to pass the advice along to Columbia students that they shouldn't be in the business of downloading and rebroadcasting, if it's torrenting, or otherwise supporting the distribution of these secret materials because that would call into question their respect for and ability to handle classified information in the future. Does this seem silly, appropriate, both? How do you evaluate that? And what would you tell a student that might want to work in government?
Well, I think it hangs a lot on who you're talking to and what you're advising them. So if you're trying for a job as a spook with the government, it's pretty good advice not to be spreading secrets about the government as part of your CV. Like, I ran a BitTorrent server that, you know, made available all the cable gate press. On the other hand, I think it's, you know, very important to be clear.
I should just say I've been handed an anonymous yellow pad, so it must be from a lawyer, that says Columbia thing was rescinded. Columbia seems to have had second thoughts on that. So anyway, sorry.
Okay. Good it was rescinded because, you know, the law is very unclear, as Floyd Abrams in a wonderful NPR interview made this point very strongly. Floyd Abrams, of course, is the First Amendment lawyer who also was the lawyer for the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. But Abrams' point was the law as it relates to having these documents and making them available is hopelessly overbroad in the way that it's written. It makes it sound like no matter what purpose you have in making it available, you've committed a violation of the 1912 Espionage Act. But Abrams' point was, actually, the way the law would be interpreted is you make it available for the purpose of doing harm to the United States. So if you make it available for the purpose of commenting about the bad policy that we need to rile up the government, the people to, you know, change their government to overturn, that's perfectly legitimate. But if you release it for the purpose of bringing down the American government, that would be illegitimate. And it's I think, better advice to say that you shouldn't be violating the law in at least that narrow sense of the
law. And in fact, just looking at the Columbia walk back, that's basically the line they're taking. That in reporting it, the original advice was extremely broad. It was like, you shouldn't be discussing WikiLeaks. And now it's, well, maybe you shouldn't be downloading specifically these documents. And for its part, the State Department has said, we're not giving anybody else advice. We're just telling our own employees not to access stuff that that remains classified. But your point about intent then also might explain for those curious why it's so murky what the state of the law is here and who's breaking it and, for instance, what Julian Assange could be arrested for. And as a practical matter, it could typically be a very difficult case to bring, certainly against the New York Times for its role here, because its intention is not to harm the security of the United States, but instead to be a newspaper. Assange may be a different story because his declared intentions may have put him within the I'm trying to bring down the government category.
Yeah, and again, to bring out some very important fact about WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks is not Assange, right? WikiLeaks is a whole bunch of people who have been working on this project for a number of years. A lot of them have motives that are very different from Assange's, worse in some cases and much better in other cases. So even if you know, it'd be kind of odd to pick this guy out and his writings out to show that his objective is to bring down the United States government and somehow tie this back to the whole entity, WikiLeaks.
So a last question to wrap us up. Classic media question, hopefully asked with the right level of subtlety. How much is this an inflection point? How much is this kind of as good a marker as any, as you were hinting before about, we're in a new zone here, you just can't keep secrets that well, there's going to be thumb drives full of bulk information that one way or another is going to get out? Or is it, nah, there's been this eruption, we'll get over it, and this isn't necessarily some earth-shattering indicator?
So I don't think we're going to know enough or be able to see the extent to which it's an inflection point, because I think the relevant point of inflection is going to be inside the government as the government thinks again about how, in fact, it both keeps secrets but also deals with leaks. Because it's, you know, remember, last critical inflection point of 9/11 brought about pretty substantive changes in a whole bunch of issues around civil rights and about surveillance and to deal with what was perceived and accurately in many cases to be a great and gravest threat to the United States. Here, too, the claim will be this is a huge threat, and we need to devote an extraordinary amount of government resources to figure out how to deal with this threat. And the way to deal with this threat is not in the American tradition going to be we need to pass laws that make it possible for us to shut down servers by filing lawsuits against them. It might be we need to better develop our cyber warfare technologies to make it effectively impossible for this to really work. There's a lot of ambiguity about exactly how governments around the world respond to these sorts of things.
And the extent to which they could see denial of service attacks or other tools designed to bring down servers as part of a legitimate tool set to stop the spread of.
They will certainly think of it as within a tool set. And my question is, to what extent does legitimacy get into that conversation? That's the critical yes. question.
And I guess we close too again with the observation, is it different when it's government secrets at work? One difference that may point a way forward without too much collateral damage is that for the government generating its own secrets, it may be able to develop IT systems so that every time you look at a document as an authorized user within the government, it is subtly and untraceably watermarked with your identity. So should it leak, they'll know where to find you, short of finding the New York Times or Julian Assange or something. And that could be a real deterrent to leaking, except for those who really think it's important or even beyond their own direct self-interest to leak stuff because for some reason it's so important that the public know. For the other secrets that may become available in bulk, there may not be as simple a means of accountability. Larry, you're going to get the last word.
Any solution that hangs upon the government being sophisticated in developing technologies to deal with problems in a smart way is not a solution.
And depending on your point of view as the listener, then, that is either an incredibly depressing and pessimistic way to shut down this newscast podcast, or it's an incredibly enlivening one. As John Perry Barlow says, you cannot separate the air that chokes from the air upon which wings beat. I don't know if that's true, but it sounded profound to me. From all of us here at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, good luck. Watch where you click.
Thanks again for listening. You can find out more information and comment on today's show by going to our show notes at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman or send us a tweet at Radio Berkman. This show was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with help today from Rebecca Tabaski, Molly Soder, Lisa Carlovati, Zelena Gray, and of course our two hosts, Lawrence Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain, and the fellows of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.